You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the thought of math can scare a lot of people off, but we'll talk to a mathematician who says it doesn't have to be scary.
Now, cannabis is still illegal at the federal level for both medical and recreational uses, but a number of states have legalized one or both types of use, including some of Wisconsin's neighbors. Minnesota has legalized medical use, while Illinois and Michigan have legalized all uses. Wisconsin allows the use of CBD, which is an extract of cannabis without mind-altering properties.
This patchwork of laws and the continuing federal ban has slowed research into the medical uses of cannabis, and that's put people who rely on it into a sort of limbo.
Dee Hall is the managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, also known as Wisconsin Watch. She joins us to discuss their recent article, Wisconsinites Use Cannabis as a Medicine, but research and the law are not yet quite on their side. It's part of their series called The Cannabis Question. Dee, good to have you back with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So 33 states and the District of Columbia have authorized medical use of cannabis, but that's in conflict with federal law. What's the current status of medical marijuana at the federal level?
So it's currently illegal, except for a very small number of approved drugs by the FDA that use either synthetic cannabis or actual cannabis. But yes, it's still illegal on the federal level.
And you found that this has a pretty significant impact on research and testing of the medical uses of cannabis. What kind of impact does that status as illegal at the federal level have?
Right. So right now it's on a schedule of drugs. It's a Schedule I drug, which is the most serious drugs that we have. And that makes it very, very difficult to research. There are a lot of hoops that researchers have to go through. For example, cocaine is a Schedule II drug because it has some recognized medical uses. So the first thing, a lot of experts believe that cannabis is misclassified. But the, you know, researchers just have a hard time obtaining cannabis. They have a hard time obtaining cannabis of various potencies, for example. They have a hard time getting the approvals to study it at all. So there are many, many barriers. And that's why we actually don't know a ton about what cannabis can do.
As a layperson, it seems to me a circular argument because it sounds like, well, it's so dangerous that we can't allow research, but it's classified as a Schedule I drug because there are no proven medical uses. But without the research, how do you find those uses? Is that right?
Right. So yes, that is the problem. And so there is a movement. You know, people would like to reclassify the drug. But short of that, there have been some studies. There's been some research. It has found the National Academies of Science and Engineering back in 2017 looked at the best uses for cannabis. They found substantial evidence that it can work on chronic pain, specifically pain related to nerve pain. It also helps with chemotherapy-associated nausea and vomiting, and the muscle spasms that you get if you have multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. Sorry. There's some evidence, moderate evidence, for helping people sleep if they have sleep apnea, fibromyalgia, chronic pain, and also MS. And then there's some evidence, more limited evidence, for increasing your appetite and reducing weight loss if you have HIV. Also, it helps with some of the symptoms of Tourette's syndrome, MS, and PTSD. So, you know, again, these are of the studies that have been done. This is the kind of the level of proof that that the National Academy of Sciences was able to find for cannabis.
But that it sounds like that has not been convincing because it's still a Schedule I drug.
Right. So, you know, you can still use these drugs for medically approved uses. But again, it's a chicken and an egg problem. So long as it remains a Schedule I drug, the research into it will probably remain limited.
So, of course, as is always the case, behind numbers and behind policies, there are human beings. And you've shared, you know, some of the different conditions and diseases where cannabis has been found to be somewhat effective. Can you share some stories of people who are really relying on this?
Well, throughout our series, it's called The Cannabis Question. And throughout our series, we have actually featured people who use cannabis for a variety of uses. And we found several people use it for Crohn's disease. And that's a chronic digestive condition that's very painful and very debilitating. Now, in terms of the research into Crohn's, there isn't a lot of it, but people are finding it to relieve their symptoms. So we did find that. There was another woman who was using it not only for Crohn's disease, but she believes, again, research for this is very, very limited, that it may be holding off the spread of skin cancer that she has been suffering from as a result of having her immune system compromised. We also have featured a man who has glaucoma, and he's had glaucoma his entire life. And he has been using it for literally decades to try to alleviate the pain and the vision loss that he has been suffering throughout his life. So a lot of people are using cannabis based on anecdotal evidence. We did feature a young woman who has Rett syndrome, and it is a very devastating disease. It affects everything about a child from the way, you know, their ability to speak, to breathe, to eat, to walk. It's a devastating condition. And this young woman, her family would love for her, this child, would love for her to be able to try some medical marijuana, but that's not available in the state of Wisconsin legally. So she does use CBD, which is allowed, low THC, which is the psychoactive ingredient mm-hmm. in cannabis, is legal in Wisconsin.
But so it's an extract from cannabis.
It doesn't have the effects on your brain. Mm-hmm. And so she is using that right now, and it really has improved her quality of life. But her parents would love for her to be able to use, you know, because she's in such a desperate situation, they would love for her to be able to use some other cannabis products that maybe will help her.
We're talking with Dee Hall right now. She's managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. We're talking about a recent article from the Center for Investigative Journalism that talks about the impact on people who have found benefits from using cannabis products, but with the illegality in Wisconsin and at the federal level, are having a hard time accessing those medications. And Dee, we hear so much about the opioid crisis, and there has been a lot of work to kind of shut down access to opioids. But as you said, a lot of people who have chronic pain are using cannabis or would use cannabis. Those are also often people who have a hard time getting the opioids that have helped them because they're kind of caught up in this effort to limit who can get opioids. So it sounds like those people are being cut off from potentially two different things that have helped them or could help them.
It could be the case, yeah. And again, because the evidence is limited, the research is limited by it being a Schedule I drug. We don't know the full range of the effects that cannabis could have, but I know that there's a thought that there are many, many, many components of cannabis that remain unstudied and may be promising, but we just don't know. But indeed, pain is one of the conditions for which cannabis and cannabis synthetic cannabinoids have been identified as being useful for people.
What do we know about public opinion at the national level in Wisconsin for providing people access to medical cannabis?
So in Wisconsin, 83% of registered voters favor medical marijuana. And we have had in recent months a bipartisan bill introduced in the state legislature that would legalize medical marijuana. I will say that the leadership of the state Senate remains opposed to this measure. We've heard some statements from the assembly speaker, from Robin Voss, that he would be open to looking at that. So it's a mixed picture. And the bipartisanship is relatively limited at this moment, but it is something that, you know, advocates for legalizing medical marijuana have some hope that perhaps there will be enough of these types of, you know, individual stories that folks who say they are benefiting from medical marijuana that will convince the legislature to legalize it like 33 other states in D.C.
83% seems like a pretty strong majority. What do you attribute lawmakers perhaps being a little behind the curve to?
Well, so there's always the fear. I mean, there's just a general concern that you don't want to make more mind-altering substances legal in the state, even if they're being used for medical uses. I mean, the idea of some opponents is that, well, yes, you would call it, quote, medical marijuana, but what you'd really be doing is legalizing it for any use that people would want to put it to. You know, and I will just point out things like criminal background checks on all gun purchases. That is also supported by more than 80% of Wisconsin voters. And yet you could see what happened with the extraordinary session that was opened and closed in a matter of seconds. That didn't go anywhere. So, even widespread public approval does not necessarily guarantee success for an issue like medical marijuana.
Within the medical community, is there a particular push either for legalization of medical cannabis, or are there parts who are against it or are not sure at this point?
I think it's a mixed picture, but I do sense a growing acceptance of the uses of cannabis. I think there are some concerns, and we do have a story coming out quite soon that will talk about the concerns that the known bad effects of marijuana. Some of those include if you have a family history of or a diagnosis of psychosis or schizophrenia, this is a substance you should not come close to. Younger people who are teenagers or even in their early 20s, their brains are still developing, and there's concern that those people should stay away from marijuana. So we will be spooling that story out and telling more about the known dangers of marijuana in a future installment.
And Dee, as we wrap up, let's go back to some of those people that you talked about earlier who are using cannabis to treat, as you said, some pretty debilitating conditions. Where does this limbo leave them?
Well, you know, some of them basically just have people from out of state who ship them at you know, risk to themselves of criminal prosecution. They ship them high THC CBD oil. Some people literally drive to Colorado and pick up marijuana because they are suffering from, Crohn's disease or some other debilitating condition. And pretty soon they already can drive over to Illinois if they want to, because that's had medical marijuana has been legal for a while there. But that will be also legal recreationally beginning January 1. So, you know, I would anticipate there will be some folks who will be accessing it that way. And although it would remain illegal to bring it back to the state of Wisconsin, one would imagine if you're desperate enough, you might just do that. So that I guess that's the anticipation, is that it would become easier to access once it becomes legalized in Illinois, fully legalized.
Well, Dee, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Dee Hall is the managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. She joined us to discuss their recent article titled "Wisconsinites Use Cannabis as a Medicine, but Research and the Law Are Not Yet on Their Side."
Coming up, a mathematician says we can improve our lives if we live more mathematically. We'll find out how.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest ask, what does it mean to be non-religious? Researchers once assumed it meant not believing in a god or going to church or holding religious beliefs. But there may be a better way of understanding being non-religious. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, it's a classic situation in the math class. The teacher introduces a new math concept, the fractions, limits, square roots, whatever, and the student groans and says, but when are we going to use this in real life?
Well, our next guest, a mathematician, has made it her life's work to answer that classic question. And she's doing it in all sorts of ways, using music, baking, even interpersonal interaction.
Eugenia Cheng is a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She's the author of the book, The Art of Logic, Using It to Find Clarity for Life's Problems. Eugenia, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you've encountered, I'm sure, lots of people who say they have a math phobia or a fear of math, or they're just not numbers people. What do you say to them to try to bring them back into the numbers game?
I say that I sympathize, because sometimes the way that math is presented is not very conducive to children and to people who are creative, which is really everybody, I think. And so if it was all about tests and scores and getting the right answer, yes, that can be very off-putting. But math doesn't have to be like that, and there's so much more to it than that. That's what I like to say.
And you've devoted a lot of your work and writing to tapping into that creative and, I guess, even playful side of math. What does that look like to someone who hears the words playful and math and thinks they're in two different worlds?
Well, again, I sympathize, but it's important to remember, I think, that math is not just about numbers and equations, even though that part gets really emphasized in most of school math. So that's school math. And I like to say, maybe you just didn't like school math. And there's so much math that's about just thinking clearly, building structures, finding connections between different situations, bridging gaps between things, and exploration. And all of those things can be much more fun than, what's the answer to this? Now memorize your times tables.
How can we start to practice that in our daily lives?
I have written several books to try and help with that because, of course, there are so many constraints. The education system is the way it is. The standardized tests are still imposed upon people. But if we can at least be open-minded about it to start with, just like I had some really boring, uncreative dance classes at school, but I still believe that dancing can be creative. It was just that wasn't. And it's really important to show that to children because otherwise this cycle keeps going. If parents think that math is boring and off-putting, and then that can get passed on to children. And if we can use the imagination of children to say, oh, look at these shapes, or just to explore things that might be math without being afraid of getting the wrong answer. And I know it's hard, and that's why I'm trying to do a lot of work outside of universities to help with that.
The dreaded question, I think, for every math teacher is, are we going to use this in real life? And I've seen you talk about the idea of kind of a mental or a brain fitness, similar to physical fitness. You know, we may not use that exact exercise in our daily lives, but it's still good for us.
That's absolutely true, especially if you want to be a person who can think well. And I hope that we all want to be able to think well, although sometimes it can appear that some people are not thinking that well. And math is really like a core exercise, just like we do core exercises to strengthen our bodies, even though there's no activity in life that just involves our core and nothing else. And so I think that math, in its more general form, when it's not just about numbers and equations, can help us do things like understand arguments and especially understand other people's arguments, even when we don't agree with them.
In American society, probably a lot of societies, there's a sense of what kind of people are math people and what kind of people aren't. There might be gender divides, ethnic divides, class divides. How do we make it so that no matter whatever people's backgrounds are, we can all be math people?
Those beliefs can be really hurtful and inhibiting, especially for children and students. The idea that some people are math people and some people aren't is what Carol Dweck would call a fixed mindset. Instead of believing in growth and that we can all change, that the brain can change depending on what we do with it. And sometimes I think that the idea of the weird genius is very attractive because it kind of relieves us of the responsibility of trying to do any better ourselves. And it's kind of romantic and it's portrayed in movies and things as this weird person who we can go, oh, well, they're brilliant at math, but they don't have a social life, so I'm better the way I am. And the idea that you have to be weird like that, or that you either are or aren't good at math, is very unfortunate. Whereas, in fact, you know, some people may well be better than others at math in the end, but everybody can get better at it. And there is no limit, I think, to how much people can get better, or at least we don't know. There's no kind of single test that we can do, even though the standardized test people may try. There's no single test we can do to decide what your eventual potential is as a mathematician. And so I prefer not to limit anybody and just to help everybody grow.
You've described yourself as a pure mathematician and you study the mathematics of mathematics. What does that mean?
Good question. I think that pure math is the part that can appear to be the furthest away from real life because it's very abstract and it's about how structures work without the question of what we can do with them in life. But what I have realized as I go along is that the pure math part is about how to think and how to build sound arguments. And so although the research I do, it doesn't directly help with things like flying a plane or building a bridge, what it does is it gives us ways to practice thinking clearly and building good arguments for how to tell if something is true or not. And that's a big problem in life at the moment, that people go around saying all sorts of things are true. And what we really need is good frameworks for assessing the validity of different points of view. And to me, that's what pure math can help with. Even though it practices it in a very abstract realm, those techniques can be used in all of our daily life as well.
And at the opposite end of the spectrum, you've written columns on everything from the use of math in baking and in music and everyday problem solving. So going from that abstract plane, how can we be mathy in our approach to our daily problems in life?
I think that if you have a phobia or a past trauma from math, then it can cause you to want to run away from any mathematical content in anything. But I try to show that it is all around us, whether you know it's there or not, and that you can get by perfectly well without it. Many people say to me that, you know, they get by perfectly well without doing all this math, and that's true. But I try to show that if you do see the math that's going on, sometimes it can help you do things better without having to rely on and trust other people to do it for you. And I think this is important because there's a lot of people out there who are trying to fool us, be that, dare I say it, the media sometimes, and possibly politicians. People are trying to manipulate us, and having a good grounding in how to work through things ourselves can protect us from being manipulated by unscrupulous people.
Can you leave us with one exercise or thought project that we can start our path back to math?
You know, this will be surprising, but I think that empathy is a form of abstraction that is related to mathematics. I think that math is about analogies between different situations, and that empathy is about analogies between different people. So I would encourage you to find an analogy between you and someone else that helps you understand their point of view, even if it's very, very different from your own, and then to believe, if you can, that that is an aspect of mathematical thinking.
Eugenia, thank you so much for joining us today, and enjoy your trip to Wisconsin.
Thank you very much.
That's Eugenia Chang. She's scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and author of several math-related books, including The Art of Logic, Using It to Find Clarity for Life's Problems. We talked to her about making math more a part of our daily lives.
Coming up, have you talked with your aging parents about their finances? Our guest says don't wait like she did. She'll have some advice on how to have those difficult conversations and the trouble we may face if we don't. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network.
Now, here's a question for you. What do you know about your parents' finances?
If your answer is not much, you might want to remedy that. Our next guest says you'd be wise to start the conversation, and the sooner, the better.
She says she waited too long to have that talk with her mom, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and that if she had put it off any longer, the situation could have gotten really complicated in a hurry. So she's encouraging other people to take action and to avoid the major headaches she nearly experienced.
Cameron Huddleston is a journalist who covers personal finance and the life and money columnist for Go Banking Rates. She's also the author of Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. Cameron, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you write about personal finances, and then you had a personal finance issue that led you to write this book. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I'm almost embarrassed to admit that even though I am a personal finance journalist, I did not realize how important it was to have conversations with my mother about her finances. And as you said, it was almost too late when I started having these conversations. She was 65 when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. I was 35 at the time. And before that, before she was diagnosed, I could see she was having trouble with her memory. And I did act quickly to get her in to meet with an attorney to update her legal documents, which are so important. Not just the will, but the power of attorney and the living will. The power of attorney lets you name someone to make financial decisions for you. And if she had not named me and my sister, her power of attorney, before her memory had declined too much, the attorney would not have considered her competent enough to sign those documents. And then I would have had to go through a real legal nightmare of going through the court process, spending thousands of dollars and months to become her conservator. Fortunately, I did not have to go through that. But as I was having to step in and take over her finances, I was having to put together the pieces of the puzzle of her finances without knowing what that final picture was. And it was really difficult. And, you know, I want people to realize that if they have these conversations before an emergency arises, before the parents ask for help, before your parents need help, it's going to make things so much easier.
You write that there are a lot of psychological roadblocks to wanting to have this conversation. One is, for a lot of families, we don't feel comfortable talking about money, period, much less the money issues that might may be facing an aging parent.
Certainly, money is a taboo topic for a lot of people, and it's understandable that you might be reluctant to talk to your parents about their finances because you think they're going to push back, that they're going to say, this is none of your business. My advice is to not make the conversation about finances, as strange as that might sound. You can start by talking about big picture issues. Maybe, you know, mom and dad, what does retirement look like for you? Or how is your retirement going? Or do you think you're going to stay in this house? Do you have any plans to downsize? Or even talking about long-term care. You know, if you ever need any sort of care, what type of care would you want? Do you know how you're going to pay for it? Rather than, hey, mom and dad, I need to know how much is in your bank account. You don't want to approach it that way. You want to be very gentle. You want to respect that they might be uncomfortable with the conversation. But if they do push back, I want to encourage you not to give up. I do provide several different ways to start the conversation in my book. And there are a lot of different ways you can approach it. But if one approach doesn't work, try something else. Do not give up, because these conversations are so important.
Give us another maybe icebreaker if that one tactic, the let's talk about your retirement plans, doesn't open the door.
Sure. So you can use a story. This is a great way to start the conversation naturally. You might have a colleague who had to take off work to care for a parent. You might have a friend whose parent died without a will. You can use those examples and share them with your parents. You know, hey, my friend Bob, his father died recently. He didn't have a will. And it created a huge headache for the family. They were grieving the loss, and then they were trying to figure out who got what, and it just became a big nightmare. Mom and Dad, I want to make sure we avoid ending up in situations like that. Or maybe you have a friend whose parent died and had everything in place, and you can talk about how helpful that was for the family members who were left behind, because they didn't have to deal with that on top of the pain of losing a loved one. Using a story is a great way to start the conversation. If you're younger, say in your 20s, maybe early 30s, you're starting out in life, you can ask your parents for advice, because parents love giving advice. That's what they do best, or at least what they think they do best. And so you can go to them and say, you know, hey, mom and dad, I just got married. Do I need life insurance now? Do I need a will? Their answers are going to give you clues about what they have done, and you continue the conversation from there. Those are just a couple ways that you can approach it.
Talking to Cameron Huddleston, her new book is Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. Cameron, a lot of people might think, okay, this is estate planning, and that's a thing for rich people. There's not a lot of money to pass along. This is not really a conversation we need to have. You pitch your book, though, to not that group, to everybody else. Talk about that.
Right. So these conversations aren't necessarily, or really not at all, about what you're hoping to get. And you certainly shouldn't approach it that way, saying, mom and dad, let's talk about your will because I want to know what I'm getting. That's a surefire way to get your parents to shut down really quickly. These conversations are especially important for people whose parents might be lower income or middle income, because there's a greater chance they are going to need your help financially or with caregiving as they age, because they might not have the resources for a comfortable retirement. They might not have the resources to pay for long-term care. And you need to find this out sooner rather than later, so you and your parents can develop a plan, and maybe so you can even shore up your own finances to help them out if that is something that you are willing and able to do.
And you write that in some cases, parents, the aging parents in this case, might be reluctant to talk to their kids about it because they're embarrassed. They don't have everything in properly labeled binders. If they have, you know, receipts and bills, they're just in a box somewhere. What do you say to the parents about whatever their preparedness level is here?
I first want to say that for anyone out there who's thinking they don't need to have this conversation because they think their parents are on top of everything, think again. There is a very good chance your parents don't have a will. You know, less than half of adults actually have a will. They don't have a power of attorney. A very small percentage of adults have long-term care insurance to help cover the cost of long-term care. You know, a lot of baby boomers don't even have anything saved for retirement. So there is a good chance that your parents might not be financially prepared for their older age. And because of this, they might be embarrassed, and therefore they're going to be reluctant to talk with you. So you certainly, as you approach this conversation, you don't want to make it appear that you're judging them in any way. And you certainly don't want to be condescending. You want to let them know that you're trying to gather some information because you're looking out for their best interest. You want to, you know, have an idea of where they bank. It doesn't matter how much they have in the bank, but where do you bank? Because if mom and dad, if something happens to you, I need to make sure the bills get paid. If you end up in the hospital, are you writing a check or do you have things set up for automatic bill pay? I want to make sure that the mortgage gets paid, the electric bill gets paid if something happens to you. Letting them know that this conversation is happening because you want to help them if they ever need help, and not, I want to talk to you about your finances because I think you're doing something wrong. You don't want to approach it that way at all.
We're talking with personal finance writer Cameron Huddleston about how to talk to our parents about their finances. She's got a new book out called Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk. She says we need to have these conversations before our parents have health problems, retire, or ask for help themselves.
And what do you think? Have you had the financial talk with your parents? Is that an issue on your mind these days? What would give you the confidence to have those talks? And if you've already had them, what advice do you have to share? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Everybody, I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas, and thanks.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We continue our conversation about talking to our parents about their finances with Cameron Huddleston. She's a journalist who covers personal finance and the life and money columnist for Go Banking Rates. She's also the author of Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances.
You can join in on Twitter. Have you talked with your parents about their financial situation, or your kids for that matter? How did it go? What worked well or not so well? Are you afraid to go down that road? What advice would you share with others about having these conversations? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Okay, Cameron, we've broken the ice. We got the conversation started. You mentioned things like power of attorney. What are some of the other key agenda items that we really have to put at the top of our list?
Well, certainly find out if they have essential legal documents. Like I said, and like you said, the will, the power of attorney, the living will, these have to be drafted and signed while your parents are still mentally competent. You also want to get an idea of how they pay their bills, because if there were an emergency to arise and you had to make sure those bills were getting paid, you need to know how they're getting paid. You want to get a general sense of where they stand financially. It doesn't have to be dollars and cents in their accounts, but you want to know if they're in retirement. Are they relying solely on Social Security, or do they have other sources of retirement income? Are they still paying a mortgage? Do they have other types of debt? What type of insurance policies do they have? The more information you get, the better. Ideally, you really want to get everything, and that includes every account they have, the usernames, the passwords. And I realize that a lot of parents are going to be reluctant to just hand over that sort of information. There are a few who do. I even have some friends whose parents give them an updated spreadsheet every 6 months, if you can believe that. But one thing you can do is actually get them to make a list. Write it down, because they might be uncomfortable telling you this, but if they write it down, they can put that list someplace safe and tell you how to access it and under what circumstances you can access it. And this still gives them control, because a lot of times parents are reluctant to have these conversations because they feel like they're giving up control, and it's a role reversal. The kids are suddenly stepping into the parent role, and parents don't like that. So let them maintain control by writing a list for you and then telling you how to access it and when you can access it.
Let's bring on a caller now. Beth is with us in Dubuque. Beth, hi.
Hello. So I think this conversation is beautiful, by the way. We lost my mom about 2 years ago, and we had her for 4 months from diagnosis to her passing, and she lost control of her mental capacity, and my dad didn't know. She was the financial carrier. She took care of all of the finances. It took upwards to 6 months for us to find all of the bank accounts and to find all of the life insurance policies. And he didn't know, you were talking about the online banking, he didn't have that information. And so when we went to go look in things and pay bills, we couldn't do that because we didn't have access, and he didn't have access. And banks are not easy to, you know, transfer, and, you know, sending out death certificates. All of those things are really, really super difficult. And it took us upwards to 6 months to, you know, 9 months to get him situated. And we're still working with him and having those conversations on a regular basis with him.
Well, Beth, good luck with that. And I'm sorry as that anniversary comes up. But an illustration there, Cameron, of how crucial this can be to do it now again instead of waiting.
Yes, I'm so glad she shared that story, because I've heard many stories like that when a parent dies and there's a parent left behind and that parent hasn't been involved with the finances and that parent is struggling. These conversations that you initiate with your parents can also help them get on the same page, because they might not be. And you might never actually have to get involved with your parents' financial lives while they are living. But yes, everyone does die, and you have to deal with what they've left behind. And as Beth's story illustrates, it can be a nightmare trying to get access to accounts, to figure out what accounts your parents even have, because I didn't have conversations soon enough with my mom about her finances before she developed dementia. There was one account of hers that I didn't even know existed, and it was almost turned over to the state as unclaimed property. There was $50,000 in that account. Luckily, I found out about it before we lost it, and I was able to use that for almost a year's worth of her care in an assisted living facility.
Beth, thanks for that call. We don't have a ton of time left. I want to share a question from Mark, who asks if there's a difference between a handwritten will and something a lawyer actually does all official-like. Is that an important distinction, Cameron, when we talk to our parents?
It is. If your parents have only a handwritten will, that's certainly better than nothing. But ideally, you would like to meet with an attorney to have a will drafted. There are low cost and free wills available online, but if they can afford to meet with an attorney and have one that's drafted to their specific situation, that's best. And if your parents don't have a lot of money to afford meeting with an attorney, maybe you as the child can volunteer to pay for it.
Mark, thanks for that question. And Cameron, we've got the holidays coming up later this year. A lot of people try to take that kind of time. Give us a game plan to get ourselves ready, maybe brace ourselves at that when we're actually seeing our family, to at least open the door on this conversation.
You don't want to bring up the conversation during the middle of a holiday gathering, but
sure. If
you can wait till after the holiday meal to have the conversation, if that's the only time your whole family's together, then that's better than nothing. But don't, you know, don't wait till Thanksgiving and say, hey, let's pass the turkey and tell me about your will, Mom and Dad. That's not the perfect time.
We'll leave it there, Cameron. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cameron Huddleston is a journalist who covers personal finance and the Life and Money columnist for Go Banking Rates. We talked to her about her book, Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. For decades, Paul DeMaine was one of the nation's most prolific and influential Native American journalists. His newspaper, The News from Indian Country, ran for more than 33 years.
This year, DeMaine published the newspaper's last issue. At 64, he's ready for his own next chapter. Rob Menser spent time with DeMaine on the Lakota Ray Reservation and brings us this report.
Paul DeMaine learned the value of independence in his first year as a journalist. It was the late 70s. He was working as both newspaper editor and communications director for the Lakota Ray tribe in northern Wisconsin. He'd been there for about a year when the FBI served search warrants on the chairman's office. The tribal chairman told him what to write in the press
Lakota
release.
Ray tribe, blah, 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 blah. There are no FBI agents here. They are not confiscating documents. They are not serving search warrants.
He sent the press release.
And an hour later, I sent a second news story out describing how the police had arrived at 11:25 and served a search warrant on the tribal government and were surging.
And that, DeMaine says, is the difference between a public relations employee and a newspaper editor. DeMaine made a lousy public relations employee. But he became a great newspaper editor. DeMaine launched the News from Indian Country in 1986. It would grow to reach a national audience. In August, the newspaper published its last issue.
Let's take a look at the building.
The sign is down from the front of News from Indian Country. The inside is a mess.
You realize that we've already sent a lot of boxes and stuff.
The newspaper provided a digest of stories about indigenous communities from coast to coast and beyond.
I would have to read, you know, 1,000 copies of the New York Times or the Washington Post in order to get the concentrated number of indigenous-related stories.
That's Patty Lowe, a longtime broadcast journalist in Wisconsin who now heads the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. She says the closure of the newspaper and its website is a blow.
It just makes me so, so sad.
Mark Trahant is editor of Indian Country Today. He says DeMaine's independence set him apart.
That vision, I think, was really extraordinary, where he saw this idea of being able to be independent by being private.
The biggest story DeMaine ever broke was also one that went squarely against what his audience wanted to hear. Working with two other Native reporters, in 2002, DeMaine published an investigation into radical Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Peltier had been convicted of killing two FBI agents on a South Dakota reservation in 1975. There are boxes and boxes of files from the investigation in DeMaine's office. He says Peltier had become a cause celeb in the Native community.
The idea that Peltier was an innocent man was almost a universal feeling at some point.
The journalists found multiple sources who had heard Peltier bragging about the killings. They uncovered evidence that a Native woman in Peltier's circle, Anna Mae Picto Aquash, may have been killed because she knew about it. The issue they published was a bombshell, spurring new investigation of Aquash's death. It also changed the way many people saw Peltier. DeMaine's Oneida name is Ska Bewis, the messenger. To him, that's always meant trying to find the truth.
I brought a message that nobody wanted to hear, but maybe nobody would listen to someone else.
Groups over here. This is all summer white oysters.
These days, DeMaine hunts mushrooms and taps maple trees on his land. It's not always easy to adjust to life without newspaper deadlines, but he's trying to take things as they come.
I've got food, shelter, people love me, I'm okay, let's get through today and live it to the best.
DeMaine is interested in food sovereignty, a movement to connect Native communities with traditional growing practices. He's inoculated a bunch of logs on his property with mushroom spawn. With any luck, they'll make for some tasty soups next spring. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, sure, turkey, stuffing, sweet potatoes, and pie are all delicious, but you're going to get tired of leftovers eventually. On Food Friday, we talk about how to make great deep dish pizza.
And we talked to an investigative journalist about his work covering the financial industry's role in the lead up to and fallout from the housing crisis and Great Recession.
And we meet a photographer who's documenting the people, places, and scenery along the Ice Age Trail of Wisconsin. All that and more tomorrow on Central Time.